Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio, Europe, your voice in Spain. The caretakers, war grave gardeners, and the secret battle to rescue Allied airmen in World War II. When the First World War ended, hundreds of British veterans stayed in France to look after the graves of their fallen countrymen as part of the newly chartered Imperial War Graves Commission. However, in 1940, the Second World War swept over Europe, stranding the gardeners in Nazi-occupied France. What happened next is the subject of a fascinating new book called The Caretakers. It's by author Caitlin Galante de Angelis. Delighted to say that Caitlin joins us live on the line now. Caitlin, good afternoon to you.
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you with us too. Whereabouts are you, by the way, today?
I live in Boston, in the US.
Very nice part of the world indeed. And I'm that worst sort of creature. I am the armchair historian. I love my Second World War because, hey, why wouldn't you? And one of the things is I keep finding stories like this, which I knew nothing about and which the finest Hollywood scriptwriter couldn't come up with.
Well, yeah, I mean, this story really grabbed me right from the beginning. I've always been really interested in cemeteries. And during the centenary of the First World War, I was in France visiting the cemeteries there. And I was at Vimy Ridge at the Canadian Memorial, and I saw a picture of Hitler visiting the Vimy Ridge Memorial in 1940 during the Battle of France. And I thought to myself, oh, right, all of these cemeteries were here during World War II. I wonder what happened to them. And looking into that, all of these stories of these gardeners who joined the resistance, who helped save Allied airmen, just came out, and I went from there.
Because, I mean, I always thought that after the First World War, the graves were sort of tended by local people. I didn't realize that it was tended by people from the Imperial War Graves Commission.
Yeah. So the Imperial War Graves Commission was an organization founded in 1917, and they hired British, Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, South African gardeners to take care of the graves of their comrades. And most of them were men who had fought in those units and just stayed on. They married, many of them married French women. They had French children and Belgian as well. They're in Belgium as well. I mean, my book's mostly about France, but they stayed and they created families and they became part of the community. So later, when the Nazis came, they were friends with the local people. They had extended families, and that made it easier for them to be part of these networks of resistance.
I mean, quite a brave thing to actually stay when, I mean, I know that France falls very, very quickly indeed, but still you thought they would have been on the first boat across the channel and back to Blighty.
Yeah. Well, what happened was about half of them did evacuate. So in 1940, there were 526 employees in France and Belgium, and about half of them from France did escape. But what happened was the Imperial War Graves Commission wasn't expecting France to fall. And so they ordered all of the gardeners to stay at their posts until they got an explicit order to leave. And of course, that order never came. They never got an explicit order to leave. So many of them stayed until it was past the point where they could escape.
And presumably, when the Nazis arrive, I mean, they're not going to desecrate war. The German army arrives. They're not going to desecrate the war graves because, as you say, I mean, Hitler has served in the First World War. Vimy Ridge obviously is, and you can argue that a lot of this, the Second World War, it's payback time, if you like. You know, Hitler wants payback time. He's served. He wants to inflict damage on France. So he's not going to actually desecrate the graves. So they will treat these people who have stayed with respect. However, from an SOE perspective, you know, a resistance perspective, these are English, native English speakers who also speak French now because they've been living there for years. So they are very, very useful indeed.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the situation in France was so different from the situation on the Eastern Front, where the Nazis did destroy so many, you know, cemeteries, monuments, all of those sorts of things. In France, they only destroyed certain monuments, things that were overtly offensive to the Germans. So, like, there was an Australian memorial that had an Australian soldier stabbing a German eagle. They took that one down right away. But mostly they did leave the monuments and cemeteries. And actually, the German military used them as sort of recreational activities for their young soldiers. You know, officers would take the young soldiers on tours of these battlefields. But for the gardeners, what happened to them was most of the men who were gardeners were eventually arrested by the Nazis and sent to an internment camp. Most of them sent to an internment camp in occupied Poland. But some of them stayed free, and many of their wives and children stayed free. And so the ones who stayed free and the wives and children were, as you say, native English speakers. They were extremely useful to the escape lines because of their native English skills. Some of them worked as interrogators, right? When an airman landed and the resistance needed to make sure he really was a Canadian or a British guy or an Australian, they had to be interrogated. And that was best done by someone who was a native English speaker. And so that was one of their jobs.
And yeah. We tend to think that, because the Germans invade France, France is cut off, you know, Great Britain stands alone, Churchill does his bit, etc. But if you read up on your history of the Second World War, the amount of traffic that was going across the channel in Lysanders, which are these very light aircraft, dropping operatives, taking French resistance officers, Jean Moulin, across back to the Free French building, and also the SIS and the SOE buildings. And so it wasn't a question of them sort of just waving a light and being contacted. They were able to quite quickly put in these organizational, these intelligence gathering. You've looked at three particular cases. Tell us about the first one. This is a barman from Manchester.
Yeah, so from Manchester, his name is Ben Leach, and he served in a Manchester Pals battalion during the First World War. Like many of them, he stayed, he married a French woman, they had children, and he was a gardener in Beaumont Hamel, which is a place that's very famous for its role in the first day of the Somme. So if you've been to any of these battlefields, you might remember the Newfoundland Memorial with the big caribou in Beaumont Hamel, and it's very close to Thiepval, where the big Monument to the Missing is. And so Ben Leach stayed, and he was just not arrested. By the parameters of the Nazi arrests, he probably should have been arrested, but they just kind of missed him. And so he stayed free, and he took care of a cemetery called Serre Road Cemetery Number 2, which is the largest British cemetery on the Somme. And he hid Allied airmen in the tool shed at that cemetery to hide them so that they could then be passed on down the escape lines and escape.
Because everybody's getting very excited at the moment because of Masters of the Air, you know, the big TV series. 1943, absolutely awful year to be in the either Bomber Command or the USAAF, because it's the United States Army Air Force. And these guys are leaping out of planes. They're landing in occupied territory. I mean, they are terrified, but B, to actually take in airmen was an incredibly brave thing to do.
absolutely so dangerous. And it's funny you mentioned Masters of the Air, because one of the other people that I write about in the book is a woman named Rosine Witten, who was from Arras, and she was married to a gardener. And she worked for the Comet Line. So she took airmen in and she brought them to Paris. And as I'm watching Masters of the Air, I keep pointing to people and being like, that person mentions Rosine Witten in his escape and evasion report. That person mentions Rosine Witten in his escape and evasion report. And so like she met some of the actual people who are being portrayed in that series met Rosine Witten on the ground. And there are wonderful thank you notes that her airmen wrote to her afterward about just how pleased they were to meet, you know, someone who spoke English very well and who was able to explain to them just how the escape line worked. Because one of the things that Rosine did, one of her main jobs, was to explain to them how things worked and also to pass on information about what had happened to the other members of their crew. Because every airman who got on an escape line had just been through a horrific experience where they had been shot down. They had seen very good friends be killed. They didn't know what had happened to other people. And so one of her roles was to sort of aggregate information from other parts of the resistance and communicate it to those airmen because she could speak to them.
And that's incredibly dangerous as well, because she is, if you like, a focus of all this information. If the Nazis get hold of that, I mean, A, the Comet Line is blown, but B, they're going to know who's come through from where, and they can quite easily put sort of two and two together and start arresting people up and down the line. Explain what the Comet Line was for those who don't know, by the way.
Sure. So the Comet Line was one of the largest escape lines, which are these networks of resistance who, when an airman or another fugitive is fleeing from the Nazis, they pass them from house to house, from safe house to safe house, down all the way to the Pyrenees, where they then march over the mountains, which is treacherous in itself, and get to Spain, where they can then hook up with the British intelligence and get back to the UK and back to their units. So it's a network of civilian helpers, all volunteers, all untrained. You know, the Comet Line was founded by Belgian civilians, and they were able to save, I think, about 750 airmen, and also you know, getting other resistance people out of the country. And Rosine Witten was involved in about 75 of those escapes. So about 10% of the people who went through the Comet Line met her or interacted with her in some way.
And that's an incredible journey, because they're being shot down in Flanders, in Belgian strait.
Sure.
And then they're having to go all the way through France. I mean, okay, is it Vichy France at that point? Has Vichy taken over and the occupied? Because France is split in two, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So by that point, by the time Rosine Witten was working for the Comet Line in 1943 and 1944, Vichy France was in charge. So they had several different routes, but she was on sort of a main route that went from Arras to Paris and then down to Bordeaux. And she was eventually arrested and sent to a concentration camp. She was sent to Ravensbrück, which is the, you know, the main concentration camp for women. And then on, after she was at Ravensbrück, she was sent to a sub camp where she was forced as a slave laborer to work in a munitions factory, ironically making anti-aircraft ammunition. And she was very badly wounded in an explosion in that factory when some of the ammunition that the slave laborers were working on, her job was to work on defective shells, to dismantle defective shells and salvage them for parts so they could be remade, which obviously was very dangerous. And that's why they made slave laborers do it. And she was very badly hurt.
How was she caught? Was she betrayed? Was it just one of those sort of slip-ups? Because, I mean, we like to think of the French resistance being, of the whole of France, sort of manfully and womanly standing up against the Germans. But unfortunately, the truth about the resistance, as there are so many sub-factors, the communists, even the nationalists in the resistance, plus you have a lot of French people who aren't averse to the ideas of empire, etc.
Yeah, so she was captured in a major crackdown on the Comet Line in January 1944. She was living at Comet Line headquarters in Paris and making multiple trips to Bordeaux every week. And the line was both, there was both someone inside the line whose family was threatened, and so he turned, but there was also an infiltration by the Gestapo. And so that she was arrested, but she had already had to previously flee Arras. So in the summer of 1943, her sort of little piece of the Comet line had been infiltrated separately. And so there was an event where most of her close contacts were all arrested in July 1943. She had to leave in the middle of the night, leave Arras, leave everything behind, and go to Paris. And then she continued to work until January 1944, where there was another crackdown, another infiltration, and then she was arrested.
It's incredible she survived A, Ravensbrück, B, being, you know, interrogated by the Gestapo, yeah, and then the explosion where she's working. It's amazing that she made it through and survived.
Yeah, yeah. She had a very, very hard war. She was very brave, but she did survive. I mean, the third person that I talk about in the book, Bob Armstrong, who was an Irish gardener, didn't survive. He joined the resistance. He helped airmen, and he was arrested for helping an American airman from Tennessee, a guy named Arthur Cox. And he was tried, and he was sentenced to death. And in the end, his sentence was commuted to hard labor. But by that time, he was already in really bad shape, and he died in a German prison.
So where did you start with this? I mean, how did you start to collate the information? Because I suppose a lot of it, this is one of the things about Second World War history, is now an awful lot of documents are being revealed, or more information is coming out. So again, I hadn't heard of this at all. So what was your starting point? I mean, apart from, you know, liking to hang gothically around graves.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely my starting point, was hanging around in cemeteries. But I mean, my personal starting point is just that my grandfather is a U.S. Air Force World War II veteran, and I grew up going to his reunions and meeting his friends and that sort of thing. And so when I heard about these gardeners and where they were, I was like, oh, you know, like, this is starting to sound familiar. And so I still wasn't sure I had enough information for a book. So I went to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission archives in the UK, and I started looking in the records, and I still wasn't sure. But then I started contacting some families, and both families of gardeners and families of airmen in the US. And so the families were really very generous in sharing stories with me. I think right at the beginning of the book, in the preface, I have a photograph, which is one of my favorite documents that a family shared with me. It's a photograph of the tool shed at the cemetery, Sarah Road number 2. And it was taken by the gardener, Ben Leach, and sent to one of the airmen after he was free and back home. And it says on the back, you know, thank you for staying as a guest at Sarah Road Cemetery number 2 in 1944. And just that connection that they maintained, and the stories that the families keep, are really important.
And when you get primary sources like that, when you're holding something like a letter, or a family member brings out a photograph of a grandfather or a great uncle, I mean, it doesn't get any better, does it, for putting a book together, or putting a research document together?
No, I mean, that was really amazing. It was so wonderful to talk with so many families and hear their stories, and actually also, like, discover things together. You know, there's one family that I write about where Rosine Witten helped save an airman named Joseph Wemhoor. And I contacted his grandson. And as we were talking, there was an auction online where Joseph Wemhoor's uniform and all of his medals and his, you know, his Caterpillar Club pin, right, because he had parachuted out of a disabled plane, so he was part of the Caterpillar Club, that all came up for auction. And so the grandson and I together were able to purchase it and then send it to him so that he has it all. But it came about because we were talking about it and sort of sharing information. And so there was a lot of sort of co-discovery along with families, you know, because I'm in archives all the time. So I often have papers or records that families haven't seen. So I'm always happy to share those. And then they often have wonderful things, photographs and stuff that they're willing to share.
And we're coming up this year is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. So, and as I said before, there's a tremendous interest in what happened with the airmen, because we have, as I said before, we've got this major series that's blowing everybody away, and this year we're going to have the 80th anniversary. What do you hope that people will take from the caretakers?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think I think for me, there's sort of two things. One is just, I think when we think about the First World War and the Second World War, often there are sort of these silos of interest. Like people say, I'm interested in the First World War, or I'm interested in the Second World War. And there's not always a lot of overlap. But for the people who lived through it, for these gardeners, this was one continuous experience, right? And I think that doing this research about these veterans who served in Flanders in the First World War and just stayed there, and how they experienced the Second World War, really brought home to me how these things are connected, and how for the people living through them, it was all sort of together. And so that's something that I thought was really interesting about this project. And then also just about, you know, like, these are just ordinary people. Like, they did work with SOE, and there was actually an SOE agent, a woman named Elaine Madden, who was the daughter of a Wargraves employee, and SOE loved her because she spoke English and French and Flemish, and so they recruited her. Like, oh, come on. And they parachuted her back into Belgium. But most of these people have no training. They have no, very little resources. Like, they're working class people. Sometimes when we think about the resistance or British people in the resistance, there's this idea that they were like upper class or rich, or like, these people are gardeners. They are working people, and they were really able to, you know, really save lives by working within their communities, right? I don't want to discount the work of all of the French people that they worked with and say, like, no, it was just the British. No, of course, they worked with French neighbors and family members. But just, you know, it was inspiring, I think, to me to just see them actually acting, right? Ordinary people taking action.
And the other thing, of course, that we always look at this because we're sitting here 80 years later. So, spoiler alert, we know how this ends. But right. Of course, they didn't. And so for them, it is a continuation of things. I mean, the bravery, the stress they must have gone through, because at any moment there could be a knock on the door, somebody could open the tool shed, and it's all over. And I think that's one of the great things about this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's hard to recapture just sort of how much danger they were in, and how, you know, sometimes it's hard to understand how they took the risks that they took. You know, I think before I started writing this book, I had this idea that, you know, people helped airmen and maybe they hid them away in like an underground cave or something. But, you know, I'm reading this book and sometimes, you know, they just have to get on the train, right? Rosine Witten has to take people on the train. And so what she does is she buys them German magazines. And she says, pretend to be reading this magazine on the train and don't talk to anyone, right? Because you don't speak French. Ironically, that guy, Joseph Wemhoer, who she helped, his native language was German. I mean, for a lot of the Americans, they spoke German or Polish or Lithuanian. And so there actually are stories of American airmen who evaded capture by speaking their native Polish and posing as like Polish agricultural laborers in France, because then they weren't expected to speak French.
So, amazing, yeah. Stuff. The book, where can people find you online, by the way, if people want to find you on the socials, or is there a website, where can they find you?
Yeah. So, I have a website, CaitlinDeAngelis.com, and I'm also on whatever we're calling Twitter these days, occasionally.
Before, yeah, the artist formerly known as Twitter X, otherwise, yeah. SpaceX exactly. This week, probably, but yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but The Caretakers is available now in all of your favorite online and hopefully some local bookshops.
Absolutely. Support your local bookstore, and you can also order it online from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Caretakers, Wargrave Gardeners and the Secret Battle to Rescue Allied Airmen in World War II. It's by Caitlin Galante de Angelis. Caitlin, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been great.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion. It's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.